did not come in. During this time, the baby girl, Yong Dong, was breastfed by all the women of the village. The one who nursed her the most was Hunter Chi's daughter-in-law, called Fang. Fang had the strong, solid frame of the women of the Northeast. She ate sorghum every day, and her large breasts were full of milk, even though she was feeding two babies at the same time. Other nursing women in Chi Jiatun also came to feed Yong Dong. They liked her, saying that the baby had the same clever air as her mother. Gradually, Hunter Chi's home became the gathering place for all the women of the village. Old and young, matrons and maidens, they all liked to stop by when they had nothing else going on. They admired Ye and were curious about her, and she found that she had many women's topics to discuss with them. On countless days, Ye held Yong Dong and sat with the other women of the village in the yard, surrounded by birch posts. Next to her was a lazy black dog and the playing children, bathing in the warm sunlight. She paid attention especially to the women with the copper tobacco pipes. Leisurely, they blew smoke out of their mouths, and the smoke, filled with sunlight, gave off a silvery glow, much like the fine hairs on their plump limbs. One time, one of them handed her the long-stemmed cupronickel pipe and told her it would make her feel better. She took only two hits before she became dizzy, and they laughed about it for several days. As for the men, Ye had little to say to them. The matters that occupied them all day also seemed outside her understanding. She gathered that they were interested in planting some ginseng for cash while the government seemed to be relaxing policies a little, but they didn't quite have the courage to try. They all treated Ye with great respect and were very polite toward her. She didn't pay much attention to this at first, but after a while, after observing how those men roughly beat their wives and flirted outrageously with the widows in the village, saying things that made her blush, she finally realized how precious their respect was. Every few days, one of them would bring a hare or pheasant he had caught to Hunter Chi's home. They also gave Yong Dong strange and quaint toys that they'd made with their own hands. In Ye's memory, these months seemed to belong to someone else, like a segment of another life that had drifted into hers like a feather. This period condensed in her memory into a series of classical paintings, not Chinese brush paintings, but European oil paintings. Chinese brush paintings are full of blank spaces, but life in Chi Jiatun had no blank spaces. Like classical oil paintings, it was filled with thick, rich, solid colors. Everything was warm and intense, the heated Kong stove beds lined with thick layers of Yura sedge, the Guandong and Mohi tobacco stuffed in copper pipes, the thick and heavy sorghum meal, the 65-proof Baijiu distilled from sorghum. All of these blended into a quiet and peaceful life, like the creek at the edge of the village. Most memorable to Ye were the evenings. Hunter Chi's son was away in the city selling mushrooms, the first to leave the village to earn money elsewhere, so she shared a room in his house with Fang. Back then, there was no electricity in the village, and every evening, the two huddled around a kerosene lamp. Ye would read while Fang did her needlework. Ye would lean closer and closer to the lamp without noticing, and her bangs would often get singed, at which point the two of them would glance up and smile at each other. Fang, of course, never had this happen to her. She had very sharp eyes and could do detailed work even in the dim light from heating charcoal. The two babies, not even half a year old, would be sleeping together on the Kong next to them. Ye loved to watch them sleep. They are even breathing, the only sound in the room. At first, Ye did not like sleeping on the heated Kong, and often got sick, but she gradually got used to it. As she slept, she would imagine herself becoming a baby sleeping in someone's warm lap. The person who held her wasn't her father or mother, or her dead husband. She didn't know who it was. The feeling was so real that she would wake up with tears on her face. One time, she put down her book and saw that Fang was holding the cloth shoe she was stitching over her knee and staring into the kerosene lamp without moving. When she realized that Ye was looking at her, Fang asked,
"Sister, Why do you think the stars in the sky don't fall down?
Yeah, examine, Fang. The kerosene lamp was a wonderful artist and created a classical painting with dignified colors and bright strokes. Fang had her coat draped over her shoulders, exposing her red belly band, and a strong, graceful arm. The glow from the kerosene lamp painted her figure with vivid, warm colors, while the rest of the room dissolved into a gentle darkness. Close attention revealed a dim red glow, which didn't come from the kerosene lamp, but the heating charcoal on the ground. The cold air outside sculpted beautiful ice patterns on the window panes with the room's warm, humid air.
"You're afraid of the stars falling down?"
Yeah asked softly. Fang laughed and shook her head.
"What's there to be afraid of? They're so tiny."
Yeah did not give her the answer of an astrophysicist. She only said,
"They're very, very far away. They can't fall."
Fang was satisfied with this answer and went back to her needlework. But Yeah could no longer be at peace. She put down her book and lay down on the warm surface of the Kong, closing her eyes. In her imagination, the rest of the universe around their tiny cottage disappeared, just the way the kerosene lamp hid most of the room in darkness. Then she substituted the universe in Fang's heart for the real one. The night sky was a black dome that was just large enough to cover the entirety of the world. The surface of the dome was inlaid with countless stars, shining with a crystalline silver light, none of which was bigger than the mirror on the old wooden table next to the bed. The world was flat and extended very far in each direction, but ultimately there was an edge where it met the sky. The flat surface was covered with mountain ranges like the greater Qing'an Mountains, and with forests dotted with tiny villages, just like Chi Jiatun. This toy box-like universe comforted Ya, and gradually it shifted from her imagination into her dreams. In this tiny mountain hamlet, deep in the greater Qing'an Mountains, something finally thawed in Ya Wenxia's heart. In the frozen tundra of her soul, a tiny, clear lake of meltwater appeared. Ya eventually returned to Red Coast Base with Yang Dong. Another 2 years passed, divided between anxiety and peace. Ya then received a notice. Both she and her father had been politically rehabilitated. Soon after, a letter arrived for her from Tsinghua, stating that she could return to teach right away. Accompanying the letter was a sum of money, the back pay owed to her father after his rehabilitation. Finally, at base meetings, her supervisors could call her comrade. Ya faced all these changes with equanimity, showing no sign of excitement or elation. She had no interest in the outside world, only wanting to stay at the quiet, out-of-the-way Red Coast base. But for the sake of Yang Dong's education, she finally left the base that she had once thought would be her home for the rest of her life and returned to her alma mater. Leaving the mountains, Ya felt spring was everywhere. The cold winter of the Cultural Revolution really was over, and everything was springing back to life. Even though the calamity had just ended, everything was in ruins, and countless men and women were licking their wounds. The dawn of a new life was already evident. Students with children of their own appeared on college campuses. Bookstores sold out of famous literary works. Technological innovation became the focus in factories, and scientific research now enjoyed a sacred halo. Science and technology were the only keys to opening the door to the future, and people approached science with the faith and sincerity of elementary school students. Though their efforts were naive, they were also down to earth. At the first National Conference on Science, Guo Muro, president of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, declared that it was the season of rebirth and renewal for China's battered science establishment. Was this the end of the madness? Were science and rationality really coming back? Ya asked herself these questions repeatedly. Ya never again received any communication from Tri-Solaris. She knew that she would have to wait at least 8 years to hear that world's response to her message, and after leaving the base, she no longer had any way of receiving extraterrestrial replies. It was such an important thing, and yet she had done it all by herself. This gave her a sense of unreality. As time passed, that sense grew ever stronger. What had happened resembled an illusion, a dream. Could the sun really amplify radio signals? Did she really use it as an antenna to send a message about human civilization into the universe? Did she really receive a message from the stars? Did that blood-hued morning, when she had betrayed the entire human race, really happen? And those murders? Yeah, tried to numb herself with work so as to forget the past, and almost succeeded. A strange kind of self-protective instinct caused her to stop recalling the past, to stop thinking about the communication she had once had with another civilization. Her life passed this way, day after day, in tranquility. After she had been back at Tsinghua for a while, Ya took Dong Dong to see her grandmother, Xiao Lin. After her husband's death, Xiao had soon recovered from her mental breakdown and found ways to survive in the tiny cracks of politics. Her attempts to chase the political winds and shout the right slogans finally paid off, and later, during the return to class, continue the revolution phase, she went back to teaching. But then Xiao did something that no one expected. She married a persecuted, high-level cadre from the education ministry. At that time, the cadre still lived in a cowshed for reform through labor. This was part of Xiao's long-term plan. She knew that the chaos in society could not last long. The young rebels who were attacking everything in sight had no experience in managing a country. Sooner or later, the persecuted and sidelined old cadres would be back in power. Her gamble paid off. Even before the end of the Cultural Revolution, her husband was partially restored to his old position. After the third plenary session of the 11th CPC Central Committee, he was soon promoted to the level of a deputy minister. Based on this background, Xiao Lin also rose quickly as intellectuals became favored again. After becoming a member of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, she very wisely left her old school and was promoted to be the vice president of another famous university. Ya Wenxia saw this new version of her mother as the very model of an educated woman who knew how to take care of herself. There was not a hint of the persecution that she went through. She enthusiastically welcomed Ya and Dong Dong, inquired after Ya's life during those years with concern, exclaimed that Dong Dong was so cute and smart, and meticulously directed the cook in preparing Ya's favorite dishes. Everything was done with skill, practice, and the appropriate level of care. But Ya could clearly detect an invisible wall between her mother and herself. They carefully avoided sensitive topics and never mentioned Ya's father. After dinner, Xiao Lin and her husband accompanied Ya and Dong Dong down to the street to say goodbye. Then Xiao Lin returned home, while the deputy minister asked to have a word with Ya. In a moment, the deputy minister's kind smile turned to frost, as though he had impatiently pulled off his mask.
"We're happy to have you and the child visit in the future, under one condition. Do not try to pursue old historical debts. Your mother bears no responsibility for your father's death. She was a victim as well. Your father clung to his own faith in a manner that was not healthy and walked all the way down a blind alley. He abandoned his responsibility to his family and caused you and your mother to suffer."
"You have no right to speak of my father,"
Ya said, anger suffusing her voice.
"This is between my mother and me. It has nothing to do with you."
"You're right,"
Xiao Lin's husband said coldly.
"I'm only passing on a message from your mother."
Ya looked up at the residential apartment building reserved for high-level cadres. Xiao Lin had lifted a corner of the curtain to peek down at them. Without a word, Ya bent down to pick up Dong Dong and left. She never returned. Ya searched and searched for information about the four female Red Guards who had killed her father, and eventually managed to locate three of them, All three had been sent down to the countryside and then returned, and all were unemployed. After Ye got their addresses, she wrote a brief letter to each of them, asking them to meet her at the exercise grounds where her father had died, just to talk. Ye had no desire for revenge. Back at Red Coast Base, on that morning of the transmission, she had gotten revenge against the entire human race, including those Red Guards. But she wanted to hear these murderers repent, wanted to see even a hint of the return of humanity. That afternoon after class, Ye waited for them on the exercise grounds. She didn't have much hope, and was almost certain that they wouldn't show up. But at the time of the appointment, the three old Red Guards came. Ye recognized them from a distance because they were all dressed in now-rare green military uniforms. When they came closer, she realized that the uniforms were likely the same ones they had worn at that mass struggle session. The clothes had been laundered until their color had faded, and they had been conspicuously patched. Other than the uniforms, the three women in their 30s no longer resembled the three young Red Guards who had looked so valiant on that day. They had lost not only youth, but also something else. The first impression Ye had was that, though the three had once seemed to be carved out of the same mold, they now looked very different from each other. One had become very thin and small, and her uniform hung loose on her. Already showing her age, her back was bent, and her hair had a yellow tint. Another had become thick-framed, so that the uniform jacket she wore could not even be buttoned. Her hair was messy, and her face dark, as though the hardship of life had robbed her of any feminine refinement, leaving behind only numbness and rudeness. The third woman still had hints of her youthful appearance, but one of her sleeves was now empty and hung loose as she walked. The three old Red Guards stood in front of Ye in a row, just like they had stood against Ye Zetai, trying to recapture their long-forgotten dignity. But the demonic spiritual energy that had once propelled them was gone. The thin woman's face held a mouse-like expression. The thick-set woman's face showed only numbness. The one-armed woman gazed up at the sky.
"Did you think we wouldn't dare to show up?"
the thick-set woman asked, her tone trying to be provocative.
"I thought we should see each other. There should be some closure to the past,"
Ye said.
"The past is finished. You should know that."
The thin woman's voice was sharp, as though she was always frightened of something.
"I meant spiritual closure."
"Then you want to hear us repent?"
the thick woman asked.
"Don't you think you should?"
"Then who will repent to us?"
the one-armed woman asked. The thick-set woman said,
"Of the four of us, three had signed the big character poster at the high school attached to Tsinghua. Revolutionary tours, the great rallies in Tiananmen, the Red Guard civil wars, First Red Headquarters, Second Red Headquarters, Third Red Headquarters, Joint Action Committee, Western Pickets, Eastern Pickets, New Peking University Commune, Red Flag Combat Team, the East is Red. We went through every single milestone in the history of the Red Guards from birth to death."
The one-armed woman took over.
"During the 100-day war at Tsinghua, two of us were with the Jingang Mountain Corps, and the other two with the April 14th faction. I held a grenade and attacked a homemade tank from the Jingang Mountain faction. My arm was crushed by the treads on the tank. My blood and muscle and bones were ground into the mud. I was only 15 years old."
"Then we were sent to the wilderness."
The thick-set woman raised her arms.
"Two of us were sent to Shaanxi, the other two to Hernan, all to the most remote and poorest corners. When we first went, we were still idealistic, but that didn't last. After a day of laboring in the fields, we were so tired that we couldn't even wash our clothes. We lay in leaky straw huts and listened to wolves cry in the night, and gradually we woke from our dreams. We were stuck in those forgotten villages, and no one cared about us at all."
The one-armed woman stared at the ground numbly.
while we were down in the countryside. Sometimes, on a trail across the barren hill, I'd bump into another Red Guard comrade or an enemy. We'd look at each other. The same ragged clothes, the same dirt and cow shit covering us. We had nothing to say to each other.
The thick-set woman stared at Ye.
Tong Hong Jing was the girl who gave your father the fatal strike with her belt. She drowned in the Yellow River. There was a flood that carried off a few of the sheep kept by the production team, so the party secretary called to the sent-down students, "Revolutionary youths, it's time to test your mettle." And so, Hong Jing and three other students jumped into the river to save the sheep. It was early spring, and the surface of the river was still covered by a thin layer of ice. All four died, and no one knew if it was from drowning or freezing. When I saw their bodies, I can't fucking talk about this anymore.
She covered her eyes and sobbed. The thin woman sighed, tears in her eyes.
Then later we returned to the city. But so what if we're back? We still have nothing. Rusticated youths who've returned don't lead very good lives. We can't even find the worst jobs. No job, no money, no future. We have nothing.
Yeah, had no words. The one-armed woman said,
There was a movie called Maple recently. I don't know if you've seen it. At the end, an adult and a child stand in front of the grave of a Red Guard who had died during the faction civil wars. The child asks the adult, Are they heroes? The adult says no. The child asks, Are they enemies? And the adult again says no. The child asks, Then who are they? The adult says, History.
Did you hear that?
The thick-set woman waved an arm excitedly at Ye.
History! History! It's a new age now. Who will remember us? Who will think of us, including you? Everyone will forget all this completely.
The three old Red Guards departed, leaving only Ye on the exercise grounds. More than a dozen years ago, on that rainy afternoon, she had stood alone here as well, gazing at her dead father. The old Red Guard's final remark echoed endlessly in her mind. The setting sun cast a long shadow from Ye's slender figure. The small sliver of hope for society that had emerged in her soul had evaporated like a drop of dew in the sun. Her tiny sense of doubt about her supreme act of betrayal had also disappeared without a trace. Ye finally had her unshakable ideal, to bring superior civilization from elsewhere in the universe into the human world. 27. Evans. Half a year after her return to Tsinghua, Ye took on an important task, the design of a large radio astronomy observatory. She and the task force traveled around the country to find the best site for the observatory. The initial considerations were purely technical. Unlike traditional astronomy, radio astronomy didn't have as many demands on atmospheric quality, but required minimal electromagnetic interference. They traveled to many places and finally picked a place with the cleanest electromagnetic environment, a remote, hilly area in the northwest. The Loess Hills here had little vegetation cover. Rifts from erosion made the slopes look like old faces full of wrinkles. After selecting a few possible sites, the task force stayed for a brief rest at a village where most of the inhabitants still lived in traditional cave dwellings. The village's production team leader recognized Ye as an educated person and asked her whether she knew how to speak a foreign language. She asked him which foreign language, and he said he didn't know. However, if she did know a foreign tongue, he would send someone up the hill to call down Bethune, because the production team needed to discuss something with him.
Bethune?
Ye was amazed.
We don't know the foreigner's real name, so we just call him that.
Is he a doctor?
No, he's planting trees up in the hills. Has been at it for almost 3 years.
Planting trees? What for?
He says it's for the birds. A kind of bird that he says is almost extinct.
Yeah, and her colleagues were curious and asked the production team leader to bring them for a visit. They followed a trail until they were on top of a small hillock. The team leader showed them a place among the barren Loess Hills. Yeah, felt it brighten before her eyes. There was a slope covered by green forests, as though an old yellowing canvas had been accidentally blessed with a splash of green paint. Yeah, and the others soon saw the foreigner. Other than his blonde hair and green eyes and tattered jeans and a jacket that reminded her of a cowboy, he didn't look too different from the local peasants who had labored all their lives. Even his skin had the same dark hue from the sun as the locals. He didn't show much interest in the visitors. He introduced himself as Mike Evans without mentioning his nationality, but his English was clearly American-accented. He lived in a simple two-room adobe hut, which was filled with tools for planting trees. Hoes, shovels, saws for pruning tree branches, and so on, all of which were locally made and crude. The dust that permeated the northwest lay in a thin layer over his simple and rough-hewn bed and kitchen implements. A pile of books, most of which dealt with biology, sat on his bed. Yeah noticed a copy of Peter Singer's Animal Liberation. The only sign of modernity was a small radio set hooked up to an external D battery. There was also an old telescope. Evans apologized for not being able to offer them anything to drink. He hadn't had coffee for a while. There was water, but he only had one cup.
"May we ask what you're really doing here?"
one of Yaz's colleagues asked.
"I want to save lives."
Save the locals? It's true that the ecological conditions here...
Why are you all like this? Evans suddenly became furious. Why does one have to save people to be considered a hero? Why is saving other species considered insignificant? Who gave humans such high honors? No, humans do not need saving. They're already living much better than they deserve.
We heard that you're trying to save a type of bird?
Yes, a swallow. It's a subspecies of the northwestern brown swallow. The Latin name is very long, so I won't bore you with it. Every spring, they follow ancient, established migratory paths to return from the south. They nest only here. But as the forest disappears year after year, they can no longer find the trees in which to build their nests. When I discovered them, the species had less than 10,000 individuals left. If the trend continues, within 5 years it'll be extinct. The trees I've planted now provide a habitat for some of them, and the population is rising again. I must plant more trees and expand this Eden.
Evans allowed Yan and the others to look through his telescope. With his help, they finally saw a few tiny black birds darting through the trees.
Not very pretty, are they? Of course, they're not as crowd-pleasing as giant pandas.
Every day on this planet, some species that doesn't draw the attention of humans goes extinct.
Did you plant all of these trees by yourself?
Most of them. Initially, I hired some locals to help, but soon I ran out of money. Saplings and irrigation all cost a lot. But you know something? My father's a billionaire. He's the president of an international oil company, but he'll not give me any more funding, and I don't want to use his money anymore.
Now that Evans had opened up, he seemed to want to pour his heart out.
When I was 12, a 30,000-ton oil tanker from my father's company ran aground along the Atlantic coast. More than 20,000 tons of crude oil spilled into the ocean. At the time, my family was staying at a coastal vacation home, not too far from the site of the accident. After my father heard the news, the first thing he thought of was how to avoid responsibility and minimize damage to the company. That afternoon, I went to see the hellish coast. The sea was black, and the waves under the sticky, thick film of oil were smooth and weak. The beach was also covered by a black layer of crude oil. Some volunteers and I searched for birds on the beach that were still alive. They struggled in the sticky oil, looking like black statues made out of asphalt, only their eyes proving that they were still alive. Those eyes staring out of the oil still haunt my dreams to this day. We soaked those birds in detergent, trying to get rid of the oil stuck to their bodies.
but it was extremely difficult. Crude oil was infused into their feathers, and if you brushed a little too hard, the feathers would come off with the oil. By that evening, most of the birds had died. As I sat on the black beach, exhausted and covered in oil, I stared at the sun setting over a black sea and felt like it was the end of the world. My father came up behind me without my noticing. He asked me if I still remembered the small dinosaur skeleton. Of course I remembered. The nearly complete skeleton had been discovered during oil exploration. My father spent a large sum to buy it and installed it on the grounds of my grandfather's mansion. My father then said, "Mike, I've told you how dinosaurs went extinct. An asteroid crashed into the earth. The world first became a sea of fire and then sank into a prolonged period of darkness and coldness. One night, you woke from a nightmare, saying that you had dreamt that you were back in that terrifying age. Let me tell you now what I wanted to tell you that night. If you really lived during the Cretaceous period, you'd be fortunate. The period we live in now is far more frightening. Right now, species on Earth are going extinct far faster than during the late Cretaceous. Now is truly the age of mass extinctions. So, my child, what you're seeing is nothing. This is only an insignificant episode in a much vaster process. We can have no seabirds, but we can't be without oil. Can you imagine life without oil? Your last birthday, I gave you that lovely Ferrari and promised you that you could drive it after you turned 15. But without oil, it would be a pile of junk metal and you'd never drive it. Right now, if you want to visit your grandfather, you can get there on my personal jet and cross the ocean in a dozen hours or so. But without oil, you'd have to tumble in a sailboat for more than a month. These are the rules of the game of civilization. The first priority is to guarantee the existence of the human race and their comfortable life. Everything else is secondary. Yeah, my father placed a great deal of hope in me, but in the end, I didn't turn out the way he wanted. In the days after that, the eyes of those drowned birds always followed me and determined my life. When I was 13, my father asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up. I said I wanted to save lives. My dream wasn't that great. I only wanted to save a species near extinction. It could be a bird that wasn't very pretty, a drab butterfly, or a beetle that no one would even notice. Later, I studied biology and became a specialist on birds and insects. The way I see it, my ideal is worthy. Saving a species of bird or insect is no different from saving humankind. All lives are equal, is the basic tenet of pan-species communism.
What?
Yeah, wasn't sure she had heard the last term correctly. Pan-species communism. It's an ideology I invented. Or maybe you can call it a faith. Its core belief is that all species on Earth are created equal.
That is an impractical ideal. Our crops are also living species. If humans are to survive, that kind of equality is impossible.
Slave owners must also have thought that about their slaves in the distant past.
And don't forget technology. There will be a day when humanity can manufacture food. We should lay down the ideological and theoretical foundation long before that. Indeed, pan-species communism is a natural continuation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The French Revolution was 200 years ago, and we haven't even taken a step beyond that. From this, we can see the hypocrisy and selfishness of the human race.
How long do you intend to stay here?
I don't know. I'm prepared to devote my life to the task. The feeling is beautiful. Of course, I don't expect you to understand. Evan seemed to lose interest. He said that he had to go back to work, so he picked up a shovel and a saw and then left. When he said goodbye, he glanced at Yeh again, as though there was something unusual about her. On the way back, one of Yeh's colleagues recited from Chairman Mao's essay, Remembering Bethune.
Noble-minded and pure, a man of moral integrity and above vulgar interests, he sighed. Well, there really are people who can live like that.
Others also expressed their admiration and conflicted feelings. Ya seemed to be speaking to herself as she said,
"If there were more men like him, even just a few more, things would have turned out differently."
Of course, no one understood what she really meant. The task force leader turned their conversation back to their work.
"I think this site isn't going to work. Our superiors won't approve it."
"Why not? Of the four possible sites, this has the best electromagnetic environment."
"What about the human environment? Comrades, don't just focus on the technical side. Look at how poor this place is. The poorer a village, the craftier the people. Do you understand? If the observatory were located here, there would be trouble between the scientists and the locals. I can imagine the peasants thinking of the astronomy complex as a juicy piece of meat that they can take bites from."
This site was indeed not approved, and the reason was just what the task force leader had said. 3 years passed without Ya hearing anything more about Evans. But one spring day, Ya received a postcard from Evans with only a single line.
"Come here. Tell me how to go on."
Ya rode the train for a day and a night, and then switched to a bus for many hours until she arrived at the village nestled in the remote hills of the northwest. As soon as she climbed onto that small hillock, she saw the forest again. Because the trees had grown, it now seemed far denser. But Ya noticed that the forest had once been much bigger. Newer parts that had grown in the past few years had already been cut. The logging was in full swing. In every direction, trees were falling. The entire forest seemed like a mulberry leaf being devoured by silkworms on all sides. At the current rate, it would disappear soon. The workers doing the logging came from two nearby villages. Using axes and saws, they cut down those barely grown trees one by one, and then dragged them off the hill using tractors and ox carts. There were many loggers, and fights frequently erupted among them. The fall of each small tree didn't make much sound, and there was no loud buzzing from chainsaws, but the almost familiar scene made Yaz's chest tighten. Someone called out to her, that production team leader, now the village chief. He recognized Ya. When she asked him why they were cutting down the forest, he said,
"This forest isn't protected by law." "How can that be? The forestry law has just been promulgated." "But whoever gave Bethune permission to plant trees here? A foreigner coming here to plant trees without approval would not be protected by any law." "You can't think that way. He was planting on the barren hills and didn't take up any arable land. Also, back when he started, you didn't object."
"That's true. The county actually gave him an award for planting the trees. The villagers originally planned to cut down the forest in a few more years. It's best to wait until the pig is fat before slaughtering it. Am I right? But those people from Nanga Village can't wait any longer. And if my village doesn't join in, we won't get any."
"You must stop immediately. I will go to the government to report this."
"There's no need."
The village chief lit a cigarette and pointed to a truck loading the cut trees in the distance.
"See that? That's from the deputy secretary of the county forestry bureau. And there are also people here from the town police department. They've carried off more trees than anyone else. I told you, these trees have no status and aren't protected.
You'll never find anyone who cares.
Also, comrade, aren't you a college professor? What does this have to do with you?"
The adobe hut looked the same, but Evans wasn't inside. Ya found him in the woods, holding an axe and carefully pruning a tree. He had obviously been at it for a while, his posture full of exhaustion.
"I don't care if this is meaningless. I can't stop. If I stop, I'll fall apart."
Evans cut down a crooked branch with a practiced swing.
"Let's go together to the county government. If they won't do anything, we'll go up to the provincial government. Someone will stop them."
Ya looked at Evans with concern. Evans stopped and stared at Ya in surprise. Light from the setting sun slanted through the trees and made his eyes sparkle.
"Ya, do you really think I'm doing this because of this forest?"
He laughed and shook his head, then dropped the axe. He sat down, his back against a tree.
If I want to stop them, it'd be easy. I just returned from America. My father died 2 months ago, and I inherited most of his money. My brother and sister only got $5 million each. This wasn't what I expected at all. Maybe in his heart he still respected me, or maybe he respected my ideals. Not including fixed assets, do you know how much money I have at my disposal?
About $4.5 billion.
I could easily ask them to stop and get them to plant more trees. I could make all the lowest hills within sight be covered by quick-growth forest. But what would be the point? Everything you see before you is the result of poverty. But how are things any better in the wealthy countries? They protect their own environments, but then shift the heavily polluting industries to the poorer nations. You probably know that the American government just refused to sign the Kyoto Protocol. The entire human race is the same. As long as civilization continues to develop, the swallows I want to save and all the other swallows will go extinct. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, sat silently, gazing at the rays of light cast among the trees by the setting sun, listening to the noise from the loggers. Her thoughts returned to 20 years ago, to the forests of the greater Kingon Mountains, where she had once had a similar conversation with another man.
Do you know why I came here?
Evans continued.
The seeds of pan-species communism had sprouted long ago in the ancient East.
You're thinking of Buddhism?
Yes. The focus of Christianity is man. Even though all the species were placed into Noah's Ark, other species were never given the same status as humans. But Buddhism is focused on saving all life. That was why I came to the East. But it's obvious now that everywhere is the same.
Yes, that's true. Everywhere people are the same.
What can I do now? What is the purpose of my life? I have $4.5 billion and an international oil company. But what good is all that? Humans have surely invested more than $45 billion in saving species near extinction, and probably more than $450 billion has already been spent on saving the environment from degradation. But what's the use? Civilization continues to follow its path of destruction of all life on Earth, except humans. $4.5 billion is enough to build an aircraft carrier, but even if we build 1,000 aircraft carriers, it would be impossible to stop the madness of humanity.
Mike, this is what I wanted to tell you. Human civilization is no longer capable of improving by its own strength.
Can there be any source of power outside of humanity? Even if God once existed, he died long ago.
Yes, there are other powers. The sun had set, and the loggers had left. The forest and the lowest hills were silent. Yeah now told Evans the whole story of Red Coast and Tri-Solaris. Evans listened quietly, and the lowest hills and the forest in dusk seemed to listen as well. When Yeah was finished, a bright moon rose from the east and cast speckled shadows on the forest floor. Evans said,
I still can't believe what you just told me. It's too fantastic.
But luckily, I have the resources to confirm this. If what you told me is true... He extended his hand and spoke the words that every new member of the future ETO would have to say upon joining. Let us be comrades. 28. The Second Red Coast Base. 3 more years passed. Evans seemed to have disappeared. Yeah didn't know if he really was somewhere in the world working to confirm her story, and had no idea how he would confirm it, even though, by the scale of the universe, a gap of 4 light-years was as close as touching. It was still a distance that was unimaginably far for fragile life. The two worlds were like the source and mouth of a river that crossed space. Any connections between them would be extremely attenuated. One winter, Yeah received an invitation from a not very prominent university in Western Europe to be a visiting scholar for 1/2 a year. After she landed at Heathrow for her interview, a young man came to meet her. They didn't leave the airport, but instead turned back to the landing strip. There, he escorted her onto a helicopter. As the helicopter roared into the foggy air over England, time seemed to rewind, and Ya experienced déjà vu. Many years ago, when she first rode in a helicopter, her life was transformed. Where would fate bring her now?
"We're going to the second Red Coast base."
The helicopter passed the coastline and continued toward the heart of the Atlantic. After half an hour, the helicopter descended toward a huge ship in the ocean.
As soon as Ya saw the ship, she thought of Radar Peak. Only now did she realize that the shape of the peak did resemble a giant ship. The Atlantic appeared like the forest of the greater Kingon Mountains. But the thing that reminded her most of Red Coast Base was the huge parabolic antenna erected in the middle of the ship, which resembled a round sail. The ship was modified from a 60,000-ton oil tanker, like a floating steel island. Evans had built his base on a ship. Maybe it was so that it would always be at the best position for transmission and reception, or maybe it was to hide from detection. Later, she learned that the ship was called Judgment Day. Ya stepped off the helicopter and heard a familiar howl. It was caused by the giant antenna slicing through the wind over the sea. The sound again drew her thoughts to the past. On the broad deck below the antenna, about 2,000 people stood in a dense crowd. Evans walked up to her and solemnly said,
"Using the frequency and coordinates you provided, we received a message from Trisolaris."
"We've confirmed everything you told me."
Yeah, nodded calmly.
"The great Trisolaran fleet has already set sail. Their target is this solar system, and they will arrive in 450 years.
Ya remained calm. Nothing could surprise her anymore. Evans pointed to the crowd behind him.
"You're looking at the first members of the Earth Trisolaris organization. Our ideal is to invite Trisolaran civilization to reform human civilization, to curb human madness and evil, so that the Earth can once again become a harmonious, prosperous, sinless world. More and more people identify with our ideal, and our organization is growing rapidly. We have members all over the world."
"What can I do?"
Ya asked in a soft voice.
"You will become the commander-in-chief of the Earth Trisolaris movement. This is the wish of all ETO fighters."
Ya remained silent for a few seconds. Then she nodded slowly.
"I'll do my best."
Evans raised a fist and shouted at the crowd,
"Eliminate human tyranny!"
Accompanied by the sound of crashing waves and the wind howling against the antenna, the ETO fighters shouted as one.
"The world belongs to Trisolaris!"
This was the day that the Earth Trisolaris movement formally began. 29. The Earth Trisolaris Movement.
The most surprising aspect of the Earth Trisolaris movement was that so many people had abandoned all hope in human civilization, hated, and were willing to betray their own species, and even cherished as their highest ideal the elimination of the entire human race, including themselves and their children. The ETO was called an organization of spiritual nobles. Most members came from the highly educated classes, and many were elites of the political and financial spheres. The ETO had once tried to develop membership among the common people, but these efforts all failed. The ETO concluded that the common people did not seem to have the comprehensive and deep understanding of the highly educated about the dark side of humanity. More importantly, because their thoughts were not as deeply influenced by modern science and philosophy, they still felt an overwhelming instinctual identification with their own species. To betray the human race as a whole was unimaginable for them. But intellectual elites were different. Most of them had already begun to consider issues from a perspective outside the human race.
human civilization had finally given birth to a strong force of alienation. As astounding as the speed of the ETO's growth had been, the number of members did not tell the whole story of the ETO's strength. Because most of its members had high social status, they held a lot of power and influence. As commander-in-chief of the ETO rebels, Ya was only their spiritual leader. She did not participate in the details of the organization's operation, didn't know how the ETO grew so large, and wasn't even aware of the exact number of members. In order to grow fast, the organization operated semi-openly, but the governments of the world never paid much attention to the ETO. The ETO knew that they would be protected by the government's conservatism and lack of imagination. In those organs wielding the powers of the state, no one took the ETO's proclamations seriously, thinking that they were like other extremists who spewed nonsense. And because of its members' social status, governments always treated it carefully. By the time it was recognized as a threat, the rebels were already everywhere. It was only when the ETO began to develop an armed force that some national security organs began to notice it and realize how unusual it was. Consequently, it was only within the last 2 years that they had begun to attack the ETO effectively. The members of the ETO were not of a single mind. Within the organization were complicated factions and divisions of opinion. Mainly, they fell into two factions. The Adventist group was the purest, most fundamentalist strand of the ETO, comprised mainly of believers in Evans's pan-species communism. They had completely given up hope in human nature. This despair began with the mass extinctions of the Earth's species caused by modern civilization. Later, other Adventists based their hatred of the human race on other foundations, not limited to issues such as the environment or warfare. Some raised their hatred to very abstract, philosophical levels. Unlike how they would be imagined later, most of them were realists and did not place too much hope in the alien civilization they served either. Their betrayal was based only on their despair and hatred of the human race. Mike Evans gave the Adventists their motto: "We don't know what extraterrestrial civilization is like, but we know humanity." The Redemptionists didn't appear until long after the ETO's founding. This group's nature was a religious organization, and the members were believers in the Trisolaran faith. A civilization outside the human race would doubtlessly greatly attract the highly educated classes, and it was easy for them to develop many beautiful fantasies about such a civilization. The human race was a naive species, and the attraction posed by a more advanced alien civilization was almost irresistible. To make an imperfect analogy, human civilization was like a young, unworldly person walking alone across the desert of the universe, who has found out about the existence of a potential lover. Though the person could not see the potential lover's face or figure, the knowledge that the other person existed somewhere in the distance created lovely fantasies about the potential lover that spread like wildfire. Gradually, as fantasies about that distant civilization grew more and more elaborate, the Redemptionists developed spiritual feelings toward Trisolaran civilization. Alpha Centauri became Mount Olympus in space, the dwelling place of the gods. And so the Trisolaran religion, which really had nothing to do with religion on Trisolaris, was born. Unlike other human religions, they worshipped something that truly existed. Also, unlike other human religions, it was the Lord who was in crisis, and the duty of salvation fell on the shoulders of the believer. The main path of spreading Trisolaran culture to society was the three-body game. The ETO invested enormous effort to develop this massive piece of software. The initial goals were twofold. One, to proselytize the Trisolaran religion, and two, to allow the tentacles of the ETO to spread from the highly educated intelligentsia to the lower social strata, and recruit younger ETO members from the middle and lower classes. Using a shell that drew elements from human society and history, the game explained the culture and history of Trisolaris, thus avoiding alienating beginners. Once a player had advanced to a certain level and had begun to appreciate Trisolaran civilization, the ETO would establish contact, examine the player's sympathies, and finally recruit those who passed the tests to be members of the ETO. But Threebody didn't attract much notice, because the game required too much background knowledge and in-depth thinking, and most young players didn't have the patience or skill to discover the shocking truth beneath its apparently common surface. Those who were attracted by it were still mostly intellectuals. Most of those who became redemptionists got to know Trisolaran civilization through the Three-Body game, and so Three-Body could be said to be the cradle of the redemptionists. While the redemptionists developed religious feelings toward Trisolaran civilization, they were also not as extreme as the Adventists in their attitude toward human civilization. Their ultimate ideal was to save the Lord. In order to allow the Lord to continue to exist, they were willing to sacrifice the human world to some degree. But most of them believed that the ideal solution would be to find a way to allow the Lord to continue to live in the Trisolaris stellar system and avoid the invasion of the Earth. Naively, they believed that solving the three-body problem would achieve this goal, saving both Trisolaris and the Earth. Admittedly, perhaps this thought wasn't all that naive. Trisolaris civilization itself had thought so through many eons. The effort to solve the three-body problem was a thread that ran through several hundreds of cycles of Trisolaran civilization. Most redemptionists with some in-depth math and physics knowledge had attempted the three-body problem, and even after knowing that the problem was mathematically unsolvable as posed, the effort did not cease, because solving the three-body problem had become a religious ritual of their faith. Even though the redemptionists had many first-class physicists and mathematicians, research in this area never yielded any important results. It took someone like Wei Chang, a prodigy who had no connection to the ETO or the Trisolaran faith, to accidentally come up with a breakthrough in which the redemptionists placed much hope. The Adventists and the redemptionists were always in sharp conflict. The Adventists believed that the Redemptionists were the greatest threat to the ETO. This view wasn't without reason. It was only through some Redemptionists who had a sense of duty that the governments of the world gradually came to understand the shocking background of the ETO rebels. The two factions were of approximately equal strength within the organization, and the armed forces of both had developed to the point of starting a civil war. Yawen Sia used her authority and reputation to try to patch over the division between the two, but the result was never ideal. As the ETO movement continued to develop, a third faction appeared, the Survivors. After confirming the existence of the alien invasion fleet, surviving that war became a most natural human desire. Of course, that war wouldn't occur for another 450 years and had nothing to do with those living today. But many people hoped that if humans did lose, at least their descendants who were alive in 4.5 centuries could live on. Serving the Trisolaran invaders would clearly help with this goal. Compared to the other two factions, the survivors tended to come from the lower social classes, and most were from the East, and especially from China. Their numbers were still small, but they were growing rapidly. As Trisolaran culture continued to spread, they would become a force that could not be ignored in the future. The ETO members' alienation developed variously from the faults of human civilization itself, the yearning and adoration for a more advanced civilization, and the strong desire for one's descendants to survive that final war. These three powerful motives propelled the ETO movement to develop rapidly. By then, the extraterrestrial civilization was still in the depths of space, more than 4 light-years away, separated from the human world by a long journey of 4.5 centuries. The only thing they had sent to the Earth was a radio transmission. Bill Mathers's contact as symbol theory thus received chillingly perfect confirmation. 30. Two protons. Interrogator.
We will now begin today's investigation. We hope you'll cooperate again as you did last time.
Yeah, Wincia.
You already know everything I know. In fact, by now there are many things that I'd like to learn from you.
Interrogator.